Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners of Preston FM and Swindon FM. I'm Kay Sangadafi and this is Backchat from the Bristol Radio Call. Coming up in this week's show.
He was the uncle of J.M.W. Turner, the painter. He was a very good painter. He used to come to his uncle, and there's a picture, and I think it hangs in Fitzwilliam College, Cambridge, of the castle.
We visit the ancient town of Tonbridge in Kent.
In 1420, age expectancy is 32 for men and 36 for women. Commonest cause of women's deaths in adulthood was childbirth. What I find really interesting is that 50% of all children born died before the age of five. So infant mortality is running at about 50%. And the biggest killer of children in the medieval period is from diarrhea.
And later on in the show, we visit a 15th century medieval fair and find out what life was like on and off the battlefield. I'm Kay Sangandafi, and here in the studio is Felix Haynes Worthington, who's going to talk about art. So Felix, you've just graduated from Birmingham College for doing art, so How was that for you?
Art was great, really enjoyed the course. Moved from Bristol to Birmingham, had a nice little studio space, workshops going on in the building. We had like metal and plaster and woodwork, and then a whole host of digital techniques to practice with as well, loads of computers as well, digital sort of workshops.
So if you could describe what kind of art you did, what would you say?
I'd say digital collage at the moment. I just had my degree show a couple of months ago. I had a couple of prints on the walls, and there was these large scale prints. I started off with some life drawings and then scanned them into the computers, and then did some sort of graphic design work over the top of them, and so it was figurative work. Started off with drawings. We had a little life drawing session going on. So I took that onto computers, had a good old play about with it. Took a while to learn with the programs and the software and stuff, but yeah, really good fun to do that work.
Did you find it easy to find a technology to work with that kind of art before you went to university, while you were at school?
While I was at school before, I think it was quite limited. I think they were mainly trying to get us to do painting and drawing. I mean, we had computers around, but it was more when I was around 16 to 18, I focused more on painting. And maybe when I got a bit older, I realised there were these programs which I could do drawing with and stuff. So I started to move away from painting and drawing and more basic stuff.
Would you say your art is quite contemporary?
I really like the art history. We did lots of that at A-level. And then when I got to degree level, they were like, you have to look at contemporary artists. You have to go to galleries every week. So I think it moved more.
And art as a whole, how do you think it's moving forward?
I think recently, with the economic climate, we've had the whole crash. Art's having a real hard time with cuts to arts, to all sorts of arts, like theatres. I think maybe people are trying to find maybe a bit more homespun approach to making art and working as artists, renting places for cheaper, doing stuff just any way they can, really. It's quite nice. It's quite a new way. If you wanted to sell work out of your van, you could do that. It might be an actual quite a good option. There is opportunities for us. Galleries are still going strong. I've been in Birmingham for the past 3 years. That area of Digbeth in Birmingham, so there's galleries going up all over the place. Friends who have graduated who are being able to do all sorts of stuff in the Digbeth area. So it looks like they're doing really well, actually. The people who just graduated, so they're doing okay.
Over the last decade or so, how do you think art's changed?
Getting the public interested in modern art is a sort of a part of culture which lives on the fringe of people's hectic sort of lives. Getting the public interested in really modern art and stuff which is really conceptual and maybe a little bit bonkers at times, I think is quite challenging. But arts are there for a reason. They've still got funding going on. They're always going to be there. There's always something to say and put in art galleries. So whatever's going on now, the artists are going to say about it.
Who are your heroes to get you into art?
Oh, heroes? Reading stories about people like Francis Bacon, post-war England. I think Francis Bacon is a guy who kind of stands out. It just kind of grabs you. You're kind of stood in front of a painting. It's kind of a bit shocked. They're really kind of disgusting things. So, standing in front of those, you're kind of a little bit frozen. I feel a little bit frozen when I'm looking at Francis Bacon.
So art to you is very much really making them stare at it.
Yeah, having some sort of like intensity about it. I think that's quite important, being in a gallery. Quite nice if you want to stand and think and be there for a long time, but if it's kind of gripping as well, if it has an intensity about it, that's great as well. It's kind of invigorating, kind of fills you up. People at my art school, they don't want people standing there pondering whether they're looking at a good piece of art or not. They want something which is people are kind of having an emotional response to. People don't want to make boring work, really. Yeah, that's the general feeling, I think, from my friends from Birmingham anyway.
Talking about big artists, who do you think they are? And what are they kind of doing to make people interested in art right now?
Big artists, so we've got Damien Hirst, yeah, mm-hmm. He's a pretty big one. I'm just thinking about the Tate Modern. It does bring in a lot of modern artists, but also the older artists as well. So Tracy Emin, she's a massive name on the global art scene. She had that work, which was like a tent filled with people's names, all the people she'd slept with. And I think there's lots of work about sex, sort of being open about her sex life, really, and then other personal matters. Not many people, I think, do hit that chord quite as well as Tracy Emin.
What do you think art has in store for us in the future?
People are going to start putting more of a home spin on things in the way they're working, just to be able to continue working. So people are going to find it a little bit difficult to support themselves while making artwork. So going back to where we think art is progressing, to make a living as an artist, artists maybe have to have quite a broad range of skills. It's not just being able to make images successfully, you also need to market that well to the general public.
Thanks there to Felix Worthington for that interview. This week we've been to Tonbridge in Kent, where a medieval fair has been taking place. The mayor officially opened the increasingly popular festival. Let's hear what he had to say about the town.
I'm with the mayor in Tonbridge. Hello.
Hello there, Councillor Dave David.
Can you tell us a bit about the town, the history?
Well, Tonbridge is part of Tonbridge and Morling, of which I'm mayor. And it's the largest rural borough in Kent. Tonbridge is actually a key part of it, and a very ancient part, with our wonderful castle here that dates from, I think, the 13th century.
The town changed in the last century?
Very much one that's gone from being an agricultural-based one to being a commuter-based town now, although we still have a lot of very, very important local industry in here. And a lot of things, especially associated with agriculture. Agriculture is still a major thing within Kent.
So do you have any famous citizens from this town?
Yes, perhaps the most famous recent one is Dame Kelly Holmes from the last Olympics. She's wonders for the town, especially for our youngsters and the schools here.
The oldest building in Tonbridge?
I think it's almost certainly the castle. And I should think the houses probably grew up round the castle rather than the other way around.
We take a tour of the parish church right in the centre of Tonbridge and find some hidden surprises.
We're in the porchway of Tonbridge Parish Church, called St Peter and St Paul. It is a very old church, but these here are the old fire hooks. They're very, very tall, very, very heavy. When you had a fire, houses were covered with thatch. The idea is to get the thatch off the house roof quickly to stop it spreading any further. The firemen would come in, get the hooks from here, because this is where the coach was kept for the fire thing, get the hooks down, and those big hooks right up at the top there were where they would get hold of the burning thatch, pull it off the roofs. But they're now kept in here. One of the few buildings, I should think, that have got a tall enough roof to house them, I think, more than anything.
It's a church of two halves, really. It was reordered by Ewan Christian in 1877. And this side, these are the Victorian pillars that he put in. The ones on the left here are the medieval ones. He took away the galleries that were there and practically renewed the south side. Now, the oldest part of the church is up here. This is the chancel, which is the oldest part of the church. If you look outside there, practically under that window, you'll see herringbone-type masonry, which is typical of Saxon masons. So that's why we claim to be 11th century. The two windows up there are Norman. Monument up here to Henry Harper. Henry Harper was a vicar in the late 18th century. He was the uncle of J.M.W. Turner, the painter. He was a very good painter. He used to come to his uncle, and there's a picture, and I think it hangs in Fitzwilliam College, Cambridge, of the castle. He painted that. He also made his money by painting the houses of rich people. When Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries, he sold off the land, and local people who were rich enough bought it up and became lay rects to the church. That is why you get, and you probably heard about, chancel liability, where people find in their deeds that they have to repair the church, because people like Sir Anthony were responsible for the chancel, and as the land sold off, they've inherited that responsibility, and some people have had to sell their houses. The church has had to check all the records to see that people don't have any liability, but because we're trustees, we have to do that. He's Sir Anthony Denton, and that's his wife, Elizabeth.
What age would that be? Because it looks Tudor or Elizabethan.
It is Elizabethan, yeah, yeah,
yeah. And he's in full armour. Why is that?
Well, that's just the thing. Up there you see his funereal helmet. He never jousted or anything like that, but it was carried on his coffin when he died.
And he's lying long ways, resting on his elbow.
The way the artist did it, I don't think there's... They were actually statues outside. They were outside the church, and then they were brought in. You're standing here on the grave of Jane Austen's grandfather. That's the grave. It's underneath here. He was a barber surgeon in Tunbridge. Barbers in those days cut off anything you wanted, and that's why you get a barber's pole, red and white, the blood and the bandages. He died when he was 36. His son George was brought up by an aunt in Tunbridge. He was a clever boy. He went to Tunbridge School, you know, just up the road, and then went to Oxford, gained a degree, was ordained at the same time, came back here as a master, took a curacy at Shibben, stayed at Tunbridge School for several years, went then back to Oxford, and then was offered the living of Steventon in Hampshire, where Jane Austen was born. Then he stayed there for the rest of his life until he retired. This is a sculpture by an 18th century French sculptor called Roubilliac. The Cubs love it because there's a skull at the bottom there. So anything ghoulish they like. It only denotes the soul going up to heaven, actually. That was his trademark.
Yeah, yeah. But it's quite an evil grin on that skeleton's face.
Well, they like it anyway. The boys like it. So, but it needs a bit of a clean.
Moving from Tunbridge to Capel, we visit the church of St. Thomas A. Becket. Voce Veneus, gratus et optatus, perquem nostrum animus fidelificatus, istud vinum, vinum generosum, reddit virum curialum, probum animosum.
This is St. Thomas of Becket Church near Tunbridge, and the church dates from the 12th century, and it's famous for its wall paintings which date from the 13th century. It's a redundant church, but it's still supported by the Redundant Churches Association of England. These wall paintings were discovered in 1922 when the church walls were being cleaned. The plaster fell off and these paintings were preserved behind the plaster walls. The pigments that are used in the wall paintings are probably iron oxides. They have the typical red, black, yellow coloration. The scenes are all biblical, depicting the nativity and the crucifixion and the resurrection. And in those days, people, of course, couldn't read or write, so they just told the biblical stories.
They're painted around the actual windows, aren't they? So the paintings actually go in to the window recesses.
Yes, it does. And if you look at the window that we're standing right in front of, you can see the brickwork into this little window here. It's uneven, but it's almost done by hand, and so kind of irregular, but it has a very rustic look to it, I think.
The people are wearing, from what we can see, because it's very faint now, is medieval clothes and shoes.
Yes, it is, and they're some kind of religious figures, because you can see that many of them have halos around their head, and in particular, the person in the window here has more regal halo, so he's probably some important figure. But it's not always easy to see all the detail now, since they're so old.
So the pattern at the bottom, is that Norman?
I've no idea, I can't tell you, I don't know.
But this church is dedicated to St Thomas.
St Thomas of Becket, yes. And the pilgrim route ran from London to Canterbury. And this church is more or less halfway along that route. And if you go into the church graveyard here, you'll see a very large elm tree. And the elm tree is dated from about 1100. And one of the local villagers here measured the size, and the details are all on a plaque outside the church beside the tree. And his opinion was that the church was certainly old enough to have been here at the time of Thomas à Becket. And the legend is that Thomas à Becket came and preached his sermons on the pilgrim route while travelling to Canterbury and back. So this church was built here in his memory.
Istud venum, bonum venum, venum generosum, reddit verum curialum probum animosum.
That was the church of St Thomas à Becket at Capel in Kent. From churches to country fairs, we join the revellers at this year's event in Tonbridge for a trip back in time, in the latter half of the 15th century.
There with one of the knights.
Fraser Harris from Pelican na Piaghi.
Can you tell us about your suit of armour?
Well, my suit of armour is a classical Milanese type of armour. This is a knightly armour you'd see on the battlefield. Obviously, when you're on the battlefield, you want to look your best. So you're going for the top protections. You've got enclosed greaves at the bottom, right the way up to the top of the plate, on the top of the helm. And this is the idea. This is the protection rather than movement. That's the trade-off. So, I mean, back in those times, a lord would probably pay £26 for a suit of armour, which is 2 years of his pay. So it's quite a costly, you know, investment. But in today's money, you're looking about £200,000. So that's quite an expensive piece of kit.
So how difficult is it to fight wearing one of those? What's the weight of them?
Well, the weight is about 4 stone. So it's quite heavy once it's on you. But as you see, what we wear, what's called a padded jack. Now, the padded jack works in the same way as like a judo jacket. It's basically a very thick coat that's ideal to absorb the energy. But it also helps you to attach the armour on. So the weight is not hanging on you, it's hanging on the jacket. So it's sort of supporting itself. But as you see, all the armour is articulated so you can move. I mean, some knights do backflips, but I could never do that.
So what about the sword? Are you trained in sword fighting?
Yes, we are trained in sword fighting. We adopt a Tyrolean method called Tauhofer, which was a popular 15th century swordsmaster. He would write manuals for all the scripts, but he was a very clever man. He would only give you certain parts of the manual, so you had to keep coming back to buy the next move.
Do you ever fight on horses?
I haven't fought on horses. I've fought against horses, but my hat goes off to the jousters that do that, because it's a very demanding sport.
So how close is that suit of armour to the original?
That's a replica. That's what it would have been back in the time. Obviously, it's a bit thinner now, because it's obviously made from stainless steel. They had steel back in the time, but they didn't realise what steel was. So it was iron-based, but it had carbon thrown into it. So it would make it, obviously, makes it more stronger than what was back for Bronze Age and going back times.
So what's the date of this one?
Well, this one's sort of the 15th century. So this is basically 1465. So this is when armour is at its best. At this point, you're starting to see gunpowder invented, more hand cannons. It's making armour obsolete. So armour you see after this period is more ceremonial. Something you'd see on like a joust or something like that. After that, you're sort of getting more firearms. So you're reducing the amount of armour, but all the armour is going into the breastplate. So it's twice the thickness, because obviously then it's designed to stop the bullet.
So was this more hand combat then?
Yeah, this is definitely more hand combat. On a battlefield, this is what you would definitely see, because it's the protection for knights who could afford it. If you're unfortunately a peasant, you'd be lucky if you had maybe a padded jack or gauntlets or something like that. But the idea was that if you were a peasant being levied into an army, you'd have what was called a bill, like a normal farming tool. You would take it off the small one and put it on a very long pole, because then that keeps you the distance between you and the knight. So you can keep jabbing at him and hopefully keep the distance away from all that tank.
We saw you fighting somebody. What would be the commonest form of death?
It's not exactly the nicest way, but it is the merciful. The idea is that, because obviously with all this armour on, you don't see much of the body at all, apart from a very small slit, which is across the eye. Now, unfortunately, what you would do is you would hook your opponent in the knee, drag him forward, put your knee on his chest, and then put a knife through the visor. It's obviously a very gruesome way, but in those times, it's merciful. It's very quick. If you imagine, there are some times that you would see on battle, especially if you look at War of the Roses in Towton, you would see that lovely Yorkists, after they defeated Lancastrians, would cut the tendons of their prisoners. And obviously they would be dragging away, sort of thing. And what we would use, you see, quite often is the poleaxe, which is basically a very medieval battlefield weapon, which is kind of like a Swiss army knife. It has different arrangements of weapons on the actual pole. And what they would do is they would then put the poleaxe into the back of the head as they're walking away. As they dug up the battlefield, you'd see all the skeletons with a very diamond-shaped hole in the back of the head where they've been trying to get away. Not a very chivalrous way to end, but in battlefields you just don't have the time.
Are you part of an association?
Yes, we're Pelican and Piety. We specialise in the 15th century. Well, I'm the aspect of the fighting group, but we also have our living history kitchen, which is done beautifully. So it shows all the class and what you would have from an average day peasant right the way up to what a lord would be eating.
So what's your website?
Website is pelicanandpiety.co.uk.
Replica bows of the type that were found on the Mary Rose, because until then they didn't know how big the bows were. And then when they got the Mary Rose out to sea, suddenly they found these huge big bows and great big arrows, and a lot of the heads they originally thought were for crossbows. And when they found the Mary Rose, suddenly these big heads fitted on arrows. And we do little demonstrations and shoot them, and we got a lump of steel on the floor which is the same weight as the breastplate of a suit of armour, which we shoot arrows through.
So tell us about the arrows. What's the wood? And they've got metal tips.
Yeah, they're all steel, because I had steel then. The arrows are made of poplar, with left-wing goose fletchings, which are stitched on. They're all 32 inches from the inside edge of the end of the arrow to the inside of the metal bit, the pointy bit at the end. And 32 inches is what we call a standard arrow length. When they were making arrows in the medieval period, they didn't have tape measures, but they had a loom. And so they could have a cloth yard, was how the arrow started. And then by the time you cut it to the right length, you end up with this 32-inch standard arrow. We got self-view longbows. We got one that's 140-pound draw weight, one at 130, one at 110. And they're all exact replicas of what was used during the battles of Crecy, Agincourt, etc. They've got two strings on, one to put the string on, because you can't physically reach them, because they're 7'3" tall, and I'm only 5'2", and I can't reach it to put it on. So you have these things called stringers, which is why there's two strings on each bow, and that's where the saying comes from, you've got a spare string to your bow, because you can actually use one string to put the original string on. And when the strings at the time were made of either nettle fibre or linen, when they got wet, they would stretch. And so what you would do, you'd have a spare string to your bow and you keep it dry by keeping it under your hat.
How far could an arrow travel?
Depending on what type of arrow you were shooting, the maximum range recorded was at the Battle of Crecy, where they were getting them just on 700 yards. I personally can't get anywhere near that. We've gone to Crecy and shot with a thing called a bearing arrow, and I got it about 350, 375 yards, which is only about halfway, so I would have been kicked out if I was shooting it in real life. But normal arrows for going through plate steel, through people on a battlefield, optimum range up to 250 yards, and from about 50 yards, because once the old position gets closer than 50 yards, I, being an archer, are going to run like hell the other way.
How did most people die? Arrow in the chest?
Arrows in the chest is where the fatal bit is, because if you get it in the trunk, you're going to be dead, if not then, a couple of weeks later. Most of the time, if you're in the arms, legs, etc., you're going to survive. Might have a nasty scar and an infection, but you'll survive. But Henry V was the only person we know of that actually had an arrow went through his cheek and lodged in the back of his skull, and they were able to get it out, but because he was the king's son, he had the best doctors. And they've still got the piece of kit that they used to remove the arrowhead out of his skull in Westminster Abbey.
My name is Aidan Turnbull. I'm one of the coin minters with Pelican in Her Piety, and we're making a half groat, which is worth 2 pennies, which is the amount of money a man would make working in the field for a whole day. So 2 pennies, by modern comparison, is worth about £80. It's quite big money. I mean, it would be a silver coin, but we're making them in lead-free pewter. In the past, we used to melt down tankards and make sheet pewter to punch out coins for free, but sadly modern health and safety regulations stipulate that we use lead-free pewter, so we have to buy the sheets in now and punch them out for children. I hold the hold setup, which consists of a pile, a collar and a trestle. Knock out these coins every day, so sometimes we do as many as 200 coins a day for children. And this is a half groat from 1471. It's Henry VI, who's the son of Henry V. And Henry VI went mad and believed he was made of glass, believe it or not. I would have said, "You're so transparent, Your Majesty," but... I can make a coin for you. I think that sounds jolly decent. Okay, I'll put one in. Base of the coin with the king's head engraved on it is called the pile. And the next part is called the collar, which is just a metal collar that joins it with the trussle, which is the bit that we actually hit. And now you're going to hear me strike the coin. That's a half groat, 1471. So it's a silver coin. On one side there's the king's head, Henry VI. On the other side we have our group sign, which is Pelican in Her Piety. That's a sign for suffering parenthood in the Middle Ages. So they believed that the pelican pecked its own breast in order to feed her babies. So we had it produced professionally for us. So with Henry VI on one side, Henry VI because he represents about 1470, which is the period that my medieval group covers. The reverse side would have had a big cross across it because sometimes there's a shortage of small change in the medieval period. So they'd cut it into quarters and give you a quarter of a coin representing a quarter of two pennies, I suppose. Well, that's a halfpenny, isn't it? So, that's what we do. And when I'm not coin minting, I'm manning the poo pit, which is a facsimile of a medieval latrine. So the medieval latrines were about 7 feet deep, and you'd find them in the garden of every single medieval townhouse. I lecture on medieval stomach parasites. I look at the archaeological finds that have come out of latrine systems. And I talk about the uses for excrement and for urine in the medieval period. So there's a big industry, certainly focused around excrement. So it was dug out quite regularly out of people's privies. Or latrines, and sold to farmers. So towns like Southampton are producing 60 tons of excrement a day, which is quite a phenomenal amount of poo. The urine is being saved in barrels, so a household wouldn't waste their urine by piddling it down a latrine pit. They'd actually save it in a barrel, and men would come around and buy these barrels of urine, and they'd be traded throughout the UK. They'd be barrels trundling around. Some would be sold to the dyeing industry, where the urine is used as a mordant for fixing colour to fibres. It's also used to bleach linen, to make from linen from this kind of dirty grey colour from the shirt I'm wearing to a glossy white. And you can also extract saltpetre from urine to make gunpowder. So on the one hand, you have the phenomenon of excrement going on to the land to increase crop yields and feed a population of about 4 million people. On the other hand, you've got urine being reprocessed to make gunpowder to reduce the population, to kill people. It's really a paradox, a dichotomy, whatever you want to call it. And there's also an arms race in the 15th century because they're producing handguns and cannon, bigger and better weapons. The end of the 15th century sees the decline in armour. I mean, in front of you, you've got a full set of Milanese armour, which is really armour at its apogee. It's as good as it's going to get. But by the end of the 15th century, by about 1500, armour is really being confined to sort of parade ground where people are not generally getting fully armoured up except for tournaments and parades, things like that. Medieval toilet, all townhouses would have a latrine system. In your garden, you'd probably have a pit at one end, and the pit would be lined with wattle or probably barrels with the bottom knocked out. So you'd have two or three barrels, one on top of the other. So it's a 7-foot deep hole with very defined edges to stop the soil collapsing in. And the entire household would excrete into it. So you're talking about a household of 8 to 10 people excreting through a board with a hole in it down into a pit. And once every, 2 months or so, a man called a gong farmer would come and dig this excrement out. So you'd pay him to dig out the excrement, and he'd take that out in a bucket and put it onto his cart, his night soil cart, and then he'd cart it out of the city and sell it to farmers. So there's big business, because it's a world without artificial fertilisers. So you can imagine they don't have any superphosphates, any nitrams or anything like that. And animal dung is quite difficult to collect. At the end of the day, humans, these 4 million humans who are living in the British Isles in about 1470, are the ones who are producing the best kind of excrement. So the excrement is being taken out and spread onto the lands without being composted. And this means that quite often the parasite eggs that are in the excreta are being disseminated onto the crops. 15 years ago in York, at the Coppergate dig, they found a piece of human poo that was 10.5 inches long. It must have dropped into a pit and then sunk all the way to the bottom, and it got preserved in anaerobic conditions without oxygen, so it didn't rot away. The archaeologists were able to slice it up and look at this piece of poo under an electron microscope, and they found the individual had 3 different kinds of insect parasites living in his stomach. He had threadworm, hookworm, roundworm and whipworm, and these are specially developed parasites that live in your gut. I find it really interesting because the individual, despite having 4 different parasite types in him, was able to produce a 10.5-inch long stool. It probably didn't affect him very much. I mean, you wouldn't really know you had parasites unless you were desperately short of food, unless you were, nutritionally deprived, or in case you were ill and couldn't eat very much, in which case you're competing with the parasites for energy. But most people would have had them. And in fact, they had fans of human excrement from Canterbury, which show tapeworm eggs as well, which is really interesting. So the tapeworm obviously lives inside you as a parasite and eats a bit of your food and then just grows. I mean, in the tropics, tapeworms have been known to grow to about 100 feet in length. But here in Britain, I don't think they were that long. I think, I think probably maybe 5 feet is maximum you could expect.
What was the age expectancy in the Middle Ages?
I know all about this. In about 1420, age expectancy is 32 for men and 36 for women. Commonest cause of women's deaths in adulthood was childbirth. What I find really interesting is that 50% of all children born died before the age of 5. So infant mortality is running at about 50%. And the biggest killer of children in the medieval period is from diarrhoea. And in fact, diarrhoea is the biggest killer of children in the third world today. They're drinking water that's dirty, and then they're being rehydrated with more dirty water, you see. Leads to only one outcome, that's death. You need to boil your water, you need to kill the bugs that are in them and the pathogens that are in them. Because quite often in gardens, they'd have a latrine pit at one end and a well at the other. I mean, by well, it's probably more likely there were soakaways, where you dig a hole in the ground and water naturally comes from the surrounding soil, because you can't often hit on a natural spring. Clearly, if you've got a latrine pit at one end and maybe 10, 20 feet away, you've got a well from which water's being drawn, you know there's going to be a certain amount of contamination, cross-contamination. So you're talking about infections like E. coli, which is common in our guts, but it can give us sort of dysentery-like symptoms if you ingest it. You know, it's quite an interesting world, actually, because sometimes children would fall into these latrine pits and drown. The coroner's rolls for the 15th century show lots of cases where children have fallen and drowned. And I know of at least one man who was murdered by being held by the ankles in a latrine pit and drowned in the liquid slurry. So they're not very nice places. Now, latrine pits are also places where you'd chuck your household rubbish, because there were no dustmen in the 15th century. all the rubbish would fall down into the pit and it would collect probably in the bottom 2 feet. So if the pit is about 7 feet deep, the bottom 2 feet would be the one would have all the crunchy rubbish, all the household waste. And we've got some finds here in a container which have been given to us, and they contain a typical cross-section of what they call occupation debris. So in here we have a knit comb, we've got a child's spoon, we've got a comb, we've even got a flint and steel for making fire. And in fact, you can still get sparks off it. It's quite interesting. And you also find household badges. So wherever people are sitting down and loosening their clothes to go to the toilet, they drop things. They drop rosaries, they drop coins, they drop the contents of their money pouches, which contain things like hazelnuts. I mean, the hazelnut is the sweetie of the 15th century because it's already wrapped. It's got a hard shell protecting it, keeping it clean, keeping it fresh. So you crack it open and you can eat it at any time. So the average medieval would probably have a few hazelnuts on him, you know, just to keep him going and everything like that. So I particularly like this cross-section of archaeological finds because we've got food debris in here. We've got things like cherry stones and plum stones, and some of the cherry stones have been found embedded in actual excreta, which showed that the medievals would have eaten the cherries and swallowed the stones, you see. So it comes out, it's kind of studded, as it were, with the food debris already in it. So you can tell most things about the diet that people are eating. They're eating things like bread and beans and drinking beer and a lot of vegetables. So they're producing, an average medieval adult is producing about 4 pounds of poo a day, which is really the equivalent of a small baby when you think about it. It's kind of it's quite a hefty amount. But children obviously aren't producing that much. But 4 pounds of poo a day, you've got a household of 8 to 10 people. You can imagine after 2 months or so, this poo pit would be absolutely brimming. And the other thing you find in the poo pit are billions of little fly maggot larvae cases, which indicate these places must have been hazed in flies. You'd come down to the toilet and the flies would boil out of the pit, and they'd be zooming around you, they'd be crawling all over your body and any exposed areas while you're going to the toilet. It'd be quite an awful place. I mean, I'd be inclined to only go to the toilet in the morning and the evening when fly activity is at its lowest, because flies are obviously a bit sluggish when it's cold, and when it's hot, around in clouds. And the most amazing thing I find is that you and I, we are the survivors of the survivors. Our ancestors survived pestilence and famine and warfare and natural disasters where millions of others, of men, women and children, just died. There was something special about our ancestors. They might have had an immunity to certain diseases like smallpox or tuberculosis. On the other hand, they might have had good survival strategies, they might have stored their food, they might have lived in remote areas, or they might have just been cleverer than other people. But I think for my own family that's probably not true.
finish the show off this week, let's hear one of Canterbury Tales, read by Zanna Sparrow.
Here begins the book of the Tales of Canterbury. When April with his showers sweet with fruit, the drought of March has pierced unto the root, and bathed each vein with liquor that has power to generate therein and sire the flower. When Zephyr also has, with it his sweet breath, quickened again in every holt and heath, the tender shoots and buds, the young sun, into the ram one half of his course has run, and many little birds make melody that sleep through all the night with one open eye. So nature pricks them on to ramp and rage, then do folk long to go on pilgrimage, and palmers to go seeking out strange strands to distant shrines well known in sundry lands, and specially from every shire's end of England they to Canterbury wend, the holy blessed martyr there to seek, who helped them when they lay so ill and weak. Befell that in the season on a day, in Southwark at the tabard as I lay, ready to start upon my pilgrimage to Canterbury full of devout homage. There came at nightfall to that hostelry some 29 in a company of sundry persons who had chanced to fall in fellowship, and pilgrims were they all, that toward Canterbury town would ride. The rooms and stables spacious were and wide, and well we there were eased and of best, and briefly when the sun had gone to rest, so had I spoken with them every one that I was of their fellowship anon, and made agreement that we'd early rise to take the road as you will apprise, but nonetheless whilst I have time and space, before yet farther in this tale I pace, it seems to me with accordant with reason to inform you the state of every one of all of these as it appears to me, and who they were and what was their degree, and even how arrayed there at the inn, and with a knight thus I will first begin.
And now with Tim Barrows.
Hi, this is called Halfway to Honolulu. It's bottleneck slide. Thank you.
that's all from Backchat this week. Studio guest was Felix Worthington. Features were by Anthea Page. The studio engineer was Zana Sparrow. And the producer was Anthea Page. Goodbye from me, Kay Sangadafi. Until next week, goodbye.